Welcome to Women in Politics, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio.
I'm Carol Wilson.
And I'm Chelsea Hayes-Wise,
your host.
Women in Politics. It's a platform to bring women together to talk about their engagement in politics, what's important to them, and what they want our representatives and delegates to hear. All right, and on today's show, Chelsea and I have Abigail Spanberger running for Congress in the 7th District, and we have some of our community members here on a panel to talk with her and ask some questions. So welcome Jewel Jordan, Melissa Vaughn of RVA Dirt, and Yolanda Austin. Thanks so much, everybody, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, guys. Hi. Welcome to Women in Politics. This is a really amazing panel of women that we have here today. And I just want to say thank you, ladies, for giving your time to this independent radio station that is really looking for the voices and to really hear how we can support this community in this central area of Richmond, Virginia. As always, you know, it's really interesting to go out and look for folks that are able and willing to come and talk about the issues that are going on politically. Sometimes they can be hard. These can be difficult conversations. But right now, we're going to dive right in with the candidate from the Congressional District, the 7th Congressional District, and Ms. Abigail Spanberger. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. And thank you to the other panelists for being here as well.
If you are in Richmond and you haven't been out to one of the panel conversations with all of the candidates, then you've been missing out. There have been plenty of them, so please follow along if you want to have see those candidates in person. But we wanted to also invite Abigail here today to talk a little bit about identity and how that's really played a role in her journey that started last summer. She's been going hard for many months. And also just really get an idea of what in the world would your position be able to do? What kind of impact could the community feel from this type of federal position? So tell us a little bit about what the actual position is that you're running for.
Sure. So I'm running for Congress in the 7th Congressional District, and that district is comprised of all of Culpeper, all of Orange, all of Louisa, all of Goochland, western Spotsylvania County, the western portion of Henrico, the western portion of Chesterfield, all of Powhatan, Amelia, and Nottoway. So it's a long, skinny district that wraps around Richmond City. And in that role, so running for Congress, I'm running to be a member of Congress in a federal legislative position. And so the impact that position could have on this community is really one of looking at ways that federal legislation can positively impact the people throughout the 7th District and, frankly, throughout the greater communities in Richmond. And, you know, among things that we're looking at among the things that are top issues before Congress, as I've been going across the district talking to people and voters, are issues related to healthcare, issues related to the environment, to education, to infrastructure and job opportunities, to gun violence prevention, to civil justice issues and criminal justice reform issues. And the list goes on and on. I mean, essentially just about any issue can be impacted positively or negatively by the choices that our members of Congress make. And so, you know, I'm running to be an advocate for the people of the 7th District, people within our community, but also within the state of Virginia. I am a Democrat. And, even when we look at the greater Richmond area, we have the eastern portion of Henrico, Richmond City, and the eastern portion of Chesterfield County is currently represented by Congressman McEachin, who is fantastic. And so apart from what can be done legislatively in Washington, I think there's also great potential for impact to have ideally two strong Democratic leaders in representing the region as a whole, because that would allow for a lot of conversations to be driven by people who are aligned in the views that they are working to bring into reality through federal legislation in Washington.
Okay, great. And give us a couple examples of the federal legislation that you're kind of talking about or looking to really address.
Sure. So on the issue of gun violence prevention, you know, there's multiple bills before Congress that would impact in a positive way the challenges that we're seeing throughout communities as it relates to gun violence. One of them would be providing or requiring background checks on all purchases of firearms. So there's a Brady Bill 2.0. There's another bill called the King-Thompson Bill, which would require that any purchase of a firearm require a background check. Currently across the country, states have different rules and regulations. And so there are significant numbers of firearms that are purchased. Here in Virginia, we have the gun show loophole where someone can walk in and buy a firearm without undergoing the background process, which it's looking at trying to ensuring that we are implementing the same standard across all purchases. That's one example. Mm-hmm. Other issues that are important are opportunities where we can strengthen our healthcare system. The ACA has been undermined significantly by the most recent tax reform vote because the individual mandate, which allowed for greater risk sharing across the marketplace, was undermined. So, you know, moving forward and trying to strengthen the ACA as we make longer term strides towards strengthening the American healthcare system, I think is something that's incredibly important. Estimates are that within the 7th district, we are expected to see prices and costs of premiums go up about $2,000 on average per family of four by 2025. And we expect over 20,000 additional individuals within the 7th Congressional District to lose their health care or financially no longer be able to sustain it by 2025 as well. So the impact's really pretty great.
So normally if you talk to me about advocating or following along with politics, I'm usually a big champion for look local, follow local, think local, and I am. But this conversation is actually the big ones that we are talking about when we are repeating narratives about background checks or healthcare for all or Medicare for all. When we're talking about these conversations, this is actually the position that has the ability to really change and affect that kind of legislation. So this is the bigger piece conversation, the big picture. So a lot of the conversation that we have here, remember the different levels of politics that we're really looking at, the federal, talking to Washington, cleaning out the swamp, that sort of thing. That would be Abigail's role there. So being that we are on the show Women in Politics, I want to go around and first, out of the federal legislation, the pieces that we kind of talk about, I want to ask the guest one or two issues, whether it's healthcare, immigration, taxes, gun reform, education. What are the topics, just from your own lens, and you can share what that lens is as well, is important for you to really tell Abigail as you want to see her work for? Melissa, would you mind starting for us and just kind of letting us know?
Yes. Where I come from with RVA Dirt, we do a lot of hyper-local political coverage. And when we began, we got a lot of flack for not earning our access to our local officials. And we at RVA Dirt don't believe you should have to earn any access. So access to people who we elect is important to us. Mm-hmm. How do you feel on a federal level? What kind of access should your constituents have to you? And you know how Dave Brad has a problem with having consistent town halls. What will you do to let your constituents know that you're going to be there for them and actually listen to them and not, you know, get the federal government head when you get up there?
Right off, start it quickly.
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think there's a couple different ways that you can remain. One can remain accessible to constituents. One is by the elected official himself or herself. You know, since we've launched this campaign, one of the things that we talk about frequently is a level of accessibility that we want voters to have to me as a candidate. And because it's not just about letting people ask me questions, but it's so important for me to hear the questions that they're asking, because in a question that someone poses, you can greater understand what are the concerns facing a community. I can ask follow-up questions to understand what are these issues. So over the course of the campaign since we launched last July, we've done 88 meet and greet events across the district. And those are in, you know, dining rooms, kitchens, backyards, libraries across the district. So in Congress, it would be incredibly important to me to provide that continued level of accessibility through town halls. You know, we have 10 counties within this district. There is absolutely no reason that we can't do at least one town hall in every county per year. You know, we've done 88 meet and greets. I think I can handle 10 town halls. And because we need to allow people to ask the questions that are important to them. And some of them may be really hard questions, but because so frequently these issues are emotional issues, because it relates to someone's, the health of a child, the health of a family member, their financial stability. And so I think that if someone goes out and seeks a position of elected to and chooses to be a representative and asks people to for the honor of representing them, you have to understand what their concerns and challenges are. And sometimes those conversations will be very difficult, but they're incredibly beneficial to being able to represent people. So one is doing town halls. Another is ensuring that people within my office would prioritize and understand the value of constituent services. You know, one of the really important things that elected members of Congress can do is help people in a variety of different ways, whether it's related to getting VA benefits or getting something settled in their own life, allowing and assisting someone through a process of what can be a governmental bureaucratic process that they may not fully understand is incredibly important. So ensuring that we hire people who prioritize being there and being accessible and available and compassionate to people who need assistance. And you know, being active on social media and sending out newsletters, just depending upon people, how people want to consume that level of access or information, making sure it's available on all fronts.
And giving RVA Dirt some access so that if we can't get there, we can follow RVA Dirt on Twitter and figure out
what we can do. Out of there. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Abigail. Next, I'm going to ask Ms. Jewel Jordan, who's a community organizer, and she's also in the 7th District. So very interested to see and hear from Jewel.
Loved everything you just said. As a community organizer, as an advocate, I have my ear to the street, and I hear the complaints. And I hear the frustration. A lot of the frustration, and I'll speak from the African-American community, comes from seeing politicians when it's time to vote, seeing politicians when it's election year, which in Virginia is every year. And they feel as if they're used. I understand and I hear everything that you're saying in regards to your staff. I would like to know how your staff will then reach out to organizers and advocates who are on the street, because I think there should be a common theme and a partnership there to help you all out. Because a lot of people don't understand, you're going to be busy.
Yeah.
And I'm putting it in the atmosphere that you will be elected. So there's help that needs to be there and a partnership that needs to be there and the education that needs to be there. Because some people don't know how to talk to an elected official. They don't know they have the right to speak to an elected official. So do you have any ideas or any plans on how you will communicate with the neighborhood and the community and your constituents?
Well, and I think one of the most heartbreaking things as well is that a lot of people don't think that the elected official wants to hear them. And being present as much as possible and engaging with people and asking questions and making sure that people understand that I may not be able to impact every challenge facing them, but I need to know about them, and their personal example is the best way for me to understand a greater issue. Because I can read all the books in the world, I can read every newspaper article, I can have people brief me on topics, but hearing one person's story provides not just the motivation to try and address that challenge, but also just a humanizing understanding of what's happening. And I think that you're very, very right. I hope to be incredibly busy come January, and it is important to make sure that we can connect with people within various different communities to have a point of contact and maybe to make the process easier. If someone has a concern that they may not feel comfortable calling an office in Washington, that they know they can bring it to you or someone like you and that you can be the point of contact to the office and ideally try and get something accomplished. And so, you know, we have been attempting and have been identifying people throughout various different communities to develop relationships and ask questions like, where are places that I should be? What events should I go to? Where would my presence be appreciated? Where would I have the opportunity to just sit back and listen? Where would I have the opportunity to engage and introduce myself? And trying to be as present as possible, you know, throughout our 10 counties and within cultural district or cultural communities or racial communities or, you know, neighborhoods throughout the district.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Women in Politics with Chelsea Higgs-Wise and Carol Olson. We're sitting here with Abigail Spanberger, Ywande Austin, Melissa Vaughn, that's right, Melissa Vaughn of RVA Dirt, and Jewel Jordan, talking about women in politics. Now, back to our show.
So I love these two questions because Melissa's first one was really about engaging individuals as well as the media was part of that question. So really understanding your role to engage on that level. But also what Jewel was pointing out was a real strategic approach to working with the community through the folks that are doing the work as community organizers and recognizing them, identifying them, building a relationship with them so that they could be a reliable point of contact. And so if somebody goes to Jewel and gives her a piece of information, it's not the the stress to get that information to the candidate, the candidate's people, as well as a response so that she can then take it back. Because I think as a community organizer myself, a lot of that is, yes, I've sent it to them, they've accepted it, and now everyone's just kind of in waiting of that. And so it really is not just the receiving of it, but also the conversation of the work together that's shown. And I think that could put a lot more trust in the community, especially from the Black community, to see not just the token organizers that are always there and have certain access, but everybody working together in that frame. And then they could also change their mind to say, you know what, maybe Abigail does want to hear me. Maybe I could do this myself. I don't need to go through there, because Jewel has taught me the way to approach someone that I am not filtering myself, but I'm also heard. Mm-hmm. Because these candidates and these peoples of Congress are humans. Okay. So we do have to understand that when we're speaking to one another, to keep that in mind. I know that can be hard for a lot of us, including myself included. Be honest, we get passionate. So next is Miss Yawande Austin, and just really wanted to ask her about, you know, what's on your mind? What are you looking to see changed?
Well, I'm super passionate about education, and whether I've produced educational programs in Richmond or in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, I see time and time again how education is the only way to true social and financial freedom. Yet under the current administration, we've seen virtually every group that has been historically marginalized be set back 50, 60, and in some cases 100 years. Amazing. And so under the current administration, we see how once again there's this lack of value for education. After school programs and free lunches for children who need it most are being eradicated. And we already are very, very intimately familiar with the school to prison pipeline. And I just see those numbers, unfortunately, increasing greatly without access to those lunches and after school programs. What do you think that you can do in your position to help reprioritize how we see education in this country?
So I agree with you. Education is fundamental to having any sort of opportunity to give back to society, to give back to your own family, or to change your circumstance. And there are so many ways that the federal government can positively impact while funding is predominantly done through the local or at the state level, there's so many places where the federal government can positively impact our educational system. Chief among them would be not taking public money out of public schools. And there's often a lot of discussion related to this idea of school choice, but it's really actually, I think, a false choice, because if you have a child in a home with parents who are working two or three jobs, or one parent, or you know, and be it that they live in the suburbs or they live in one of our rural areas within the district, if they don't have the car or the, you know, someone transporting them to a private school, they can't go. So it's not even an option. And so I am opposed to funneling any amount of public dollars outside of our public schools, because at that most focal point, any money that is supposed to be going to public schools needs to stay there. Then when we're looking at policies that can positively impact children, you know, I have three children myself. I know that when they are hungry, they are cranky and they are uncooperative. The notion that anyone would argue with the idea that a child who is hungry is not in the best, most optimal mindset to learn is a person who's never spent any time near a child. And so when we're looking at how we as a society, as a country, as communities can be prioritizing the potential that exists in our children in the next generation, we have to know that they need to be set up for success. And that means they need to be, they can't go into a classroom hungry, and they need to have their basic needs met. And when we look at issues related to the school to prison pipeline, there are disproportionate rates of suspension among children. Right. When we look at the number of kids who are in preschool, I believe overall population in preschool, 19% of preschoolers are Black, and over 30% of kids who get kicked out of preschool are Black. It starts off disproportionate, right? Mm-hmm. And so then when we're continuing through the school system, when you're looking at the sort of interventions that could be available to school administrators, it's incredibly important to talk about the long-term effects of trauma that children may experience in all sorts of different ways. I know you work with former child soldiers, so that's one point of trauma, but also just, you know, living day to day, not knowing if there's going to be food on your table. That is a noted and accepted form of a childhood stressor. And so when we hear people talking about we need federal funds so we can fortify our schools against gun violence, what would happen if we took that money and put it into school counselors at the earliest stages? So instead of waiting for there to be a problem at the very end, we recognize that that problem starts somewhere. And instead of trying to be reactive to a potential problem, which everyone seems more comfortable spending our money on, spend those dollars on prevention, which ultimately not only is a preventative measure, but also so positively impacts our community in a way that turning a school into a prison does not.
That was great. And so I really want to just kind of circle back with what she's saying for the listeners is that in her role and when she gets her seat in Congress, it really is going to be about where does that money go for education? That's what she is able to push, encourage, and influence about where does does that money go and who does it support and which end of the child, whether it's on the problematic reaction end or if it's to really prevent, look out, provide some type of holistic safety net for them to be cared for. That was a really great question. So,
well, and I was going to say also, when we look at childhood education, you know, there are studies that indicate that better rates of education, it's better, higher rates of civic engagement, lower rates of criminality, better rates of health outcomes. So beyond just this one particular example, the more we invest in our children and provide opportunities for them within our schools to educate themselves and to have opportunities, the better the impact on our community as a whole, not just on that individual child. And frankly, in addition to being able to have any role in creating legislation that might provide block grant funding or that might prioritize what the federal government's or that might, you know, affect or impact what the federal government's role is, I think there's just value in having legislators who are inclined to see the interrelated nature of these sorts of things because it's not an immediate fix. And so often people want an immediate fix and people want, you know, the tweet-worthy response to something. But it's about really understanding that these larger systemic problems will ultimately have greater outcomes if we look at them and understand the overall benefit of investing in one particular place, be it with our time, money, energy, or even just prioritization of what it is that we're working on.
100%. If I could interject, I know that we have a common passion also about human trafficking. And in my work internationally, I mean, the youngest trafficking victim I've ever worked with personally and professionally was 5 years old. And I met her right in the museum district when I first came to Richmond to work.
Museum District of Richmond, right?
You wanted? The museum district was sold by her mother, and familial trafficking is just a whole nother issue. But my point being is that this all originates from somewhere.
Yeah.
And if we know, for example, you're clearly already aware of the impact that lack of access to something as simple that we often take for granted as access to education can lead to a lifetime of suffering, you know. So I even have to look at that mother as what happened to her to put her in that position. Was she not in a school district where she had access to education to gain value in who she was? And getting back to trafficking, knowing today that over 60% of American youth won't graduate from school, and a high percentage of youth under the age of 18 that are trafficked are runaways and high school dropouts. There's a direct correlation. You know, I don't know how we tie value system into improving value system into the way our government is run, but it's clear that there's a trickle effect.
Yeah.
And how do we even get into this position in the first place where we undervalue something as powerful as education when those who are in leadership positions had access to that education? It didn't come from anywhere. They're in those positions because they had access.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they keep those positions.
They do. They do. And
they
have
that access.
Absolutely.
Well, we've learned so much about how people vote in this past election. Looking at overall black voters dropped a bit, so we lost the attention of black voters in the election. And the majority of white women voted for Trump.
52% of white women voted for Trump. I know this because I just wrote a whole article about it on RVA Magazine,
shout
if you guys
to
want to do
Chelsea.
That.
White ladies, hold your other white ladies
accountable. So how are you going to do that? Because looking at your district, it's a very red district that you're encompassing with a very suburban and rural areas.
Yeah.
And how are you stepping up to the plate here?
So we our district, we are, you know, the majority of our voters fall within Henrico and Chesterfield. We stretch across 10 counties. Majority are Henrico, Chesterfield, and we have Spotsylvania County as our third most populated district or portion of the district, and then we spread across rural areas. Overall, the 7th district was right at 50% for our president.
Man. Come on, guys. Come on, 7th. It hurt my whole heart.
It's really painful, actually. And we had just over 43% of the vote for Hillary Clinton. So there were a lot of third party voters in there as well. So, you know, I think the best way that I can be an advocate for the issues that are important and that I can speak to communities across the board, including white women like myself, is to just talk about how we are in a place where not only is government not actually doing much in the day-to-day function, but it is not doing things that positively impact our communities. And those are communities across the board. Those are If your concern is related to healthcare, your concern is related to children, your concern is related to the environment, you know, all of these things are being negatively impacted by the current administration and frankly by the fact that we have a Congress that is not in any way that's impactful standing up to the president when he's wrong on issues. And in fact, you know, the majority of members of Congress are supporting him kind of lockstep on things. And so for me, it's about talking about the issues that are important and advocating for the issues that are important and making sure that where people will listen to my voice, either because I'm a candidate or because I'm similar to them or because I'm their neighbor, that we're talking about the issues that are important. And I'm using that opportunity to, you know, make sure that people see the long-term ramifications of kind of falling in line with, you know, well, I've always been with this party, so I'm going to continue voting with this party. Or it can't be that bad. Well, it can't be that bad maybe for you, but it's really horrible for other people. And so making sure that people understand that even on that sliding scale of potentially who might be impacted by negative legislation, it might not be them this time, but it's them potentially next time.
This wraps up part one of Women in Politics, produced in the studios of WRIR LP 97.3 FM. Join Carol and I next week at noon.